Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. A very good day to you. I'm Larry Mantle. That Idina Menzel, of course, Into the Unknown from the soundtrack of Frozen 2. This perhaps the Let It Go for the sequel in the films. I'm joined this week by critics Charles Solomon, animation authority and critic, also with us Leah Lowenstein, and Wade Major of Synagogues.com. Well, we start with Frozen 2, the highly anticipated sequel to the hit 2013 Disney animated film. Jennifer Lee directs. The film also returns the voices of Kristen Bell, Idina Menzel, Josh Gad, and Jonathan Groff.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Kristoff, can I borrow your wagon? And Sven?
I'm not very comfortable with the idea of that.
You are not going alone.
Anna? No, I have my powers to protect me. You don't.
Excuse me, I climbed the North Mountain, survived a frozen heart, and saved you from my ex-boyfriend, and I did it all without powers. So, you know, I'm coming.
Me too. I'll drive.
I'll bring the snacks!
Chris Buck with Jennifer Lee. Lee wrote the screenplay for the film. Let me start with you, Charles. Frozen 2?
Well, this is certainly the most beautiful animated film of the year. Production designer Mike Giamo and his crew deserve all the awards they'll probably get. Ditto the effects animators. There are things that are just gorgeous. Unfortunately, the characters in the story get in front of some of those designs and effects, and it's just not what it could have been. Anna and Elsa are so busy declaring their sisterhood and epitomizing girl power and giving agency, they're not terribly interesting as characters. It's much darker than the first film. Olaf is now kind of an idiot savant, quoting all sorts of weird statistics. Josh Gad is still his voice. He's very funny. It's full of very forgettable songs. The only one I can conjure up at all is one that Olaf has about what you'll know when you grow up, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I just remember being puzzled by it. Kristoff, the reindeer herder, is all he cares about is marrying Anna. And so he's just sort of an appendage to her. He's becomes a complete cipher. He has a song accompanied by singing reindeer. Again, there's just not, the story there isn't that interesting and not that much fun.
Leo, what do you think?
Well, I have to agree. I do think visually it did some interesting things. In fact, Charles, I wanted to ask you, I thought that there were moments when it looked like there was greater depth of field than I'd seen before in the frame. And there were some animation things that seemed like they were new and innovative. But as far as the story, yeah, it did not move the franchise forward at all. In fact, it seemed to me like it had a terrible case of sequelitis, which is when a bunch of producers sit around a table and say, how can we make another one? The first one made so much money. It was sort of perfect unto itself. It didn't need a sequel.
Being a former girl yourself, the girl power themes, let me ask you about that, because Charles making it sound like it's very explicit as opposed to having it come out naturally in the characters. How did you see it?
Well, first of all, it did sort of bother me that that the whole thing of Kristoff trying to propose to Anna is like this prevailing kind of motif that keeps going throughout the film. And, you know, only when he actually succeeds in that has she kind of finally arrived. That irritated me. I didn't feel like the girl power theme came through as naturally as it did in the first one, which was a really kind of an anthem for girl power.
Wade, what were your thoughts on it?
I hate this film with a white hot passion of a thousand suns.
Glad we saved you for last.
I think it's a dreadful movie. I think it's a complete and total betrayal of the first film. It almost makes my hair stand on end. It makes me so angry. Now, in fairness, I'm the father of a six-year-old girl, and we brought her with her little friend, and they had no problem with it. As long as Anna and Anna are on screen with Olaf doing things, they don't really care. But the starter is exactly what Charles and Lale have alluded to, which is Frozen was a self-contained original movie, very loosely based on Hans Christian Andersen, but very loosely and very tangentially. And it was almost perfect. Almost. There are a few things I would like to see changed if they ever do it live action, but it was almost perfect. It doesn't really suggest a sequel. Mm-hmm. But because it made so much money, obviously they said, okay, we got to get the band back together and just do anything. And so it feels, I would be really annoyed if it was just a problem of everyone phoning it in, if the songs were just not very memorable, if the film just came to a stop every single time an unmemorable song came along. And that's all true. And the screenwriting is lazy. Things just happen for no other reason than they need to happen to move this mystical journey forward, this road trip where everyone is looking to try to solve something that has to do with these elements and in some ancient tribal rivalry with people who look like Laplanders. But that isn't even the biggest problem with it. And the things that are really a problem I can't really get into because they'd be spoilers. But it betrays the theme of the first film. It is a total betrayal of it. Everything that you were led to feel is the message of Frozen, they just throw it out the window here and say, yeah, we didn't really mean it. We actually mean the opposite. And it's gotten to a point where my daughter is now asking me a question, rather innocent question about the film, that no child should ever ask about characters in an animated film. And it's really distressing.
Well, I was going to ask how you talk with her about when you hate a movie like this that she had a great time with. How does Daddy not ruin
Daddy's
the fun?
Daddy's an old curmudgeon child.
Daddy doesn't say he hates it with the white hot passion of a thousand suns. Daddy just says it could have been better. And leaves it at that.
I'm glad you don't rain on her parade.
No, I'm not going to rain on her parade. I'll wait till she's 12 and then I'll unleash. But it is unfortunate that she is now asking a question about a relative of the characters that really should never have been an issue. Now, and I asked myself, I said, why is it that the same people who did the first film could so fail on this one? And there's one change, and I'd love for Charles to come in on it because this is the first one without John Lasseter. And I think John Lasseter's godfathering influence is deeply missing here. I don't think he would have allowed this film to go forward.
That's kind of hard to say, but there have also been a lot of changes both at Disney and at Pixar. Mm-hmm. And the brain trust, which Pete Docter always puts in air quotes, has shifted. And some of the people who were looking at all the films and critiquing them early on aren't there anymore. So I don't know that it's Lasseter alone, but I think it's several of the artists who would be kind of watching over are no longer there.
And just adding also that whereas that the prior film really, to me, felt like it preceded the merchandising, like there weren't Frozen dresses in stores when the movie came out. It was as if they hadn't even thought about how big a hit it would be. Now, of course, it is preceded by its merchandising, and it makes the whole thing feel doubly cynical.
Did you feel, as Wade did, that it sold out the first film?
I did. I did, actually. I don't feel quite as passionately as he, but I feel that it was a bit of a betrayal and disappointing for that reason.
Well, I only burn with a couple of hundred suns, but to go with one of a point that Leo made, both films were extremely challenging technically because ice is so hard to work with. It's optically active, so it can be translucent, transparent, reflective, opaque, and that was just rendering all that was an enormous problem. But they managed, again, the designers managed to find these exquisite patterns of things that it's beautiful to look at even if you're not enjoying the
visually,
story as much as you should.
Visually.
Yeah. Frozen 2 from Disney Animation. Chris Buck, Jennifer Lee direct. Jennifer Lee wrote it. Kristen Bell, Idina Menzel, Josh Gad, the voices, rated PG in theaters throughout the world. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhoods, a biographical drama from director Marielle Heller about Fred Rogers, the legendary PBS TV show host, and his friendship with journalist Tom Janot, who wrote a celebrated cover story about Fred Rogers for Esquire magazine. Tom Hanks and Matthew Reese star.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero. No, not at all.
What about Mr. Rogers? Is he a hero?
I don't understand the question.
Well, there's you, Fred, and then there's the character you play, Mr. Rogers.
The screenplay for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhoods, written by Micah Fitzerman Blue and Nora Harpster. Lael, what'd you think?
So as cynical and depressed as Frozen made me feel, this was completely 180 degrees away from it. This made me feel hopeful, genuinely transformed at the possibility of goodness in the human spirit. So Lloyd Vogler is the character based on Tom Junot, and the clip that you just played is a pivotal moment in there because he is a cynical and dispirited journalist who can't stand the idea of having to interview Fred Rogers. And when he gets the assignment, he is surprised to realize that Mr. Rogers is in fact not a character. He is actually who he plays. And the journey that he goes on, the process of discovery where he himself learns things about himself. He resolves issues in his past with in a relationship with his father that's become troubled and difficult, all thanks to Mr. Rogers. This is one of those rare movies that does what it's about. It actually teaches you. It actually brings you through it in a positive way. And the casting of Tom Hanks, I can't say enough about. He is really America's, you know, uncle. He's at this point.
He's the actor to play this role.
He is the actor to play this part. And he's so perfect. He's so spot on. He gets the cadences right. He gets the rhythms right, the mannerisms. And I loved Mr. Rogers growing up. And to have Tom Hanks playing Mr. Rogers, it's like Gregory Peck playing Atticus Finch. It's just so perfect.
Wade.
It's Ben-Hur. and what I mean by that is the genius of what Lew Wallace did when he wrote Ben-Hur and what William Wyler did to an even greater degree in the movie is they understood that when you have a perfect or a near-perfect character, that character cannot stand at the center of the movie, mm-hmm. but they can cast their light sideways and you can put another character at the center of the movie that is illuminated by that light, that is changed by it. And that's why Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, is not about the Christ, but it's about Ben-Hur. In this case, it's the same thing. Mr. Rogers is not the center of this movie. Mm. It's Matthew Reese who's the center of this movie. But
he's the protagonist.
He is the protagonist. Yeah. But Mr. Rogers shines such a remarkable light on his life that you go through exactly those same beats in that same process. And it's brilliant that they did that. I didn't know what to expect going in. I scrupulously avoided all the reviews mm-hmm. that came out of Toronto and everywhere else. And I was expecting after the documentary of a few years ago that this would be more of a straightforward biopic, but it isn't, to their credit. Mm-hmm. It is explicitly about, based on that Esquire article by Tom Junot. And it is true. Hanks is, I grew up with Mr. Rogers. Mm. It's an icon of my life, and so there is something that for all of these generations who walk in and see this film, who are all connected, parents and children and grandchildren, who are all connected to Mr. Rogers through all the years that he was on television, I think they will very wisely and smartly identify with the character played by Matthew Reese.
So Tom Junot, that character, yeah. he writes for ESPN now, and he's probably yeah. not running across a lot of Fred Rogers during the world of American professional
that's
athletics.
That's right. He's actually got a piece out in Atlantic that's all about his, all about his relationship with Mr. Rogers, came out very recently. Just wanted to say also, Marielle Heller, who did...
So good. Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Can You Ever Forgive Me? Is so good at sort of understanding the nature of what it is to be a writer, to grapple with concepts of one's reputation and image and things like that. And she gets that relationship so perfectly, I thought.
And could I also say, this is a film where people are not typically going to focus on the cinematography. It doesn't have, you know, vast vistas, and it's not necessarily a period film to that extent. But it is really beautifully shot. It is a tremendous job of cinematography because it captures so much nuance. I mean, so much of this is in a TV studio. And, you know, to make a television studio look cinematic,
yes.
a video television studio, and is rather extraordinary.
Perfectly recreates the neighborhood of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, so down to the little houses and everything.
Heller got a great performance. Can You Ever Forgive Me? It sounds like here, too. So
yeah. I
wonder how much credit also she deserves for these kinds of...
And well, the supporting cast, Chris Cooper.
She's a former actress. She's trained as an actress. She's an actor's director by all means.
We're talking about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Tom Hanks stars as Fred Rogers. Matthew Reese as the journalist Tom Juno, who's assigned to interview him, and the friendship that ensues. Mariel Heller directs. Micah Fisherman Blue and Noah Harpster wrote the screenplay. It's rated PG in wide release. Coming up, we'll hear about the drama Dark Waters, starring Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway. Also, Knives Out from writer-director Rian Johnson, starring Daniel Craig and Chris Evans. Many more films to review. It's Film Week on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Wade Major, Lael Lowenstein, Charles Solomon are with us. Next is Knives Out, a murder mystery from writer-director Rian Johnson. It features an all-star cast that includes Daniel Craig, Chris Evans, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Toni Collette.
Mr. Blanc, I know who you are. I read your profile in The New Yorker. I found it delightful. I just buried my 85-year-old father who committed suicide. Why are you here?
I'm here at the behest of a client.
Who?
I cannot say, but let me assure you this. My presence will be ornamental. You will find me a respectful, quiet, passive observer.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Of the truth.
It's an interesting accent for Daniel Craig with Jamie Lee Curtis there. Knives Out is the film. Wade?
I like it. I don't love it. I think it wants to be an Agatha Christie film, and its setup is pretty spot on, but its payoff is a little clumsy. It kind of can't tie all its loose ends up very well. It's fun. It's fun to watch everybody sort of play all of these archetypal characters, and we haven't had a great whodunit in a long time, but it just doesn't stick the landing.
What do you think, Leo?
I think I mostly agree with Wade. I'd say it doesn't aim to be exactly an Agatha Christie film so much as a kind of whodunit comedy,
yeah,
along the lines of maybe Death at a Funeral or Murder by Death along time ago. All the elements are there. You've got this gothic mansion, you've got, you know, an ensemble cast, and you've got a billionaire who suddenly dies and we have to figure out how, who, why, and so forth. It is a great cast. I felt it was mostly underutilized. Like, Jamie Lee Curtis is someone who can do pretty much anything. She doesn't have much to do. Ana de Armas has a pretty major part as the nurse, and she, interestingly, is going to be acting opposite Daniel Craig in the upcoming Bond movie, so it'll be nice to see them together again. I thought it had a lot of, you know, interesting elements. It looked like an I Spy book come to life, or a clue game come to life, but it just didn't quite, it wasn't quite incisive, wasn't quite sharp enough, if you will.
I mean, it's nicely done. Rian Johnson, you know, who has the final Star Wars film coming out shortly, too, he enjoys doing this. You can tell that he's really into it, and it's got some wonderful camera work and some fun stuff. But yeah, I wish it were
just... He loves his tracking shots, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Knives Out, rated PG-13 in select theaters. Dark Waters, drama that stars Mark Ruffalo, Anne Hathaway, and Tim Robbins. Todd Haynes directed, the screenplay from Matthew Michael Carnahan and Mario Correa. Lael.
Oh, so this is a legal thriller and a piece of film advocacy. It's a really important movie. It's pretty heavy going, and it's hard to swallow, but it's also worth seeing. So Mark Ruffalo plays Rob Bilott, and this is a true story. Bilott was a corporate attorney in Cincinnati who was approached by a farmer from West Virginia who brought him a boxload of videotapes and said, "Something's wrong. My cows are dying. Find out what's going on. And I think there's something bad afoot." Rob Bilott ends up discovering that DuPont, the chemical company, is behind a lot of this and has to go against the tide of public opinion and expose them. It's actually a very strong performance by Ruffalo. He's very earnest. I think Mark Ruffalo is one of those actors who can just about play pretty much any character. And in this case, working with so much material behooves him. It's not Aaron Brockovich, which is sort of this in a more comedic way, but
yeah. What do you
good.
Think, Wade?
I loved it. I was shocked how much I loved it. Films like this kind of have a tall hill to climb because they have so many other films that have of this genre, whether it's Spotlight or Aaron Brockovich or Absence of Malice. You could even go all the way back to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which kind of establishes the template for these man against the machine, man against the system movies. And so it's a tall hill to climb. You got a lot of stuff that you're going to compare it to when you're watching it. And it prevails. It is one of the best of its genre. It is extraordinary. And it because it doesn't get dogmatic, it doesn't sort of preach to you. It lets the facts speak for themselves. It puts the characters, not the ideology, at the center of the film. And what I was especially blown away by was Todd Haynes directing this. Mm. Todd Haynes is not your obvious director for this. Todd Haynes is a stylist. Far From Heaven and Carol and Poison and I'm Not There, I'm Not Here, whatever the that one was.
Here nor there.
Yeah. And could he do the Sidney Pollack thing? Could he do the Alan Pakula thing and subvert his style to just telling a straightforward story and let the story come up? And he does, and in a brilliant way.
I think where it works best are where you see those Todd Haynes elements. I mean, if you think back to films like, what was it, Safe, the Julianne Moore one, and Far From Heaven and so forth, it's the visual styling, of course, working with Ed Lockman, but also the sense of anxiety that is pervasive in this concern about what other people know and what they're thinking of you and so forth. That comes out very saliently
in the
film. And I thought that part worked best. The parts I didn't like as much were the sort of tropes that he has to fall back on, because this is one of those legal thrillers and there's certain boxes you have to tick. You know, that part bothered me a little bit. But I do think it's a very strong film. Certainly worth seeing.
Dark Waters is the film. Mark Ruffalo, Anne Hathaway, Tim Robbins, Bill Pullman star. Todd Haynes directs. Rated PG-13. You can see it at the Arclight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A. The drama 21 Bridges stars Chadwick Boseman. Brian Kirk directs. The screenwriters are Adam Mervis and Matthew Michael Carnahan, who we just mentioned. Wade?
I'm not sure how these movies get made sometimes. This is the kind of thing. This exact story has been made at least 100 times, if not 200 times. Chadwick Boseman plays a rugged cop who's got all the credentials and he's got all of his credibility and he's really super honest, and he goes out and he's got to solve this drug murder gone. These two guys who went to a drug den and there was more drugs there than they expected, and cops wind up dying. He's got to solve it, but you know what? There's something else going on. Something else going on in the police department, and of course, what he thinks is going on and turns into something else. And you know, we've seen this just so many times. It usually goes straight to video now. The only thing that distinguishes this is the cast. And
J.K. Simmons.
It's amazing.
Sienna Miller.
Yeah, they somehow took a really mediocre, familiar story and lined up a lot of talent, and now it's a big movie.
21 Bridges is rated R in wide release. The documentary Citizen K is directed by Alex Gibney, the prolific documentary filmmaker. Charles.
This is a very interesting movie. There's a lot of information in it that is very important to have. I would have liked it better if it weren't quite so overblown. There are many unnecessary shots of Moscow and St. Petersburg and London and parts of Prokofiev's Lieutenant Kije swelling up behind the images. Hordakovsky was one of the early oligarchs of post-Soviet Russia. He was one of six men who controlled half the entire Russian economy. He came into conflict with Putin. He went to jail for 10 years, and he's now a leading anti-Putinist, and is, I think, at his best when he's bringing out just how cold-blooded and efficient and brutally effective Putin really is. I think, again, it would be stronger if it were about 15 minutes shorter and a little more focused, but an important film with important information.
Wade, what did you think?
I like it a lot. It is true. It perhaps could use more focus, but it casts a very wide net. If you are like I think most people, where you look at Russia and you just don't quite understand what happened between 89 and now, and Putin and the rise of Putin and how he maintains power, and how Russia sort of didn't materialize as the liberal democracy that we thought it would after Glasnost. This answers all of that, and it tells you how the oligarchs became oligarchs and the relationships, and it's quite fascinating.
Citizen K is the film. Alex Gibney, the director. It's unrated. Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. The documentary When Lambs Become Lions is about the ivory trade. John Casby, the director. Lael?
Oh, this is a really fascinating and I thought very well-made cinema verite documentary in which both the poachers and the rangers in Kenya are followed. There's no narration. There's no voiceover. There's no title cards, really. There's no anything to give us any sort of outside voice or point of view. So instead, you're just there with these poachers and these rangers, seeing really both sides of this horrible situation. In and of itself, I don't think it's says quite as much about the whole ivory situation as the film The Ivory Game, which came out about 3 years ago.
Well,
which
was right.
Excellent.
That was a much
really,
worse
really good,
really yeah.
good documentary. I recommend everyone see that. But this was just what you see, really, what I got from this is that there's not much that separates the poachers and the rangers. They both want to make a living, and they're not thinking about so much what they're doing. Of course, they're being taught that this is horrible to kill these elephants, and it is, but they're far more similar than they are different, and in fact some of them are cousins and shown being together.
Charles, quick thought on this.
This disgusted me in that it doesn't make any moral judgments, and I hope that maybe the next film the director will make will be something on how nice a daddy a mafia hitman is. Or concentration camp guards were really good guys too when you get down underneath. I don't think the cinema is nearly as verite as it's supposed to be. And again, I think people would be much better to watch the earlier documentary that Leo mentioned that was much more interesting, I thought much better made.
When Lambs Become Lions, quick thought on this, Wade.
I'm kind of between the two. I like the film. I think it could have been tighter. I think it could have made its points more saliently, but it does. It is very skillful in its immersion of you in a situation in Kenya, what it is to be a person in Kenya, whether you're a poacher or a ranger. These people are not invested in any sense of national objectives.
When Lambs Become Lions, unrated, Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Peru's entry for Best International Feature Film is Retablo. Lael?
I really like this film. It's a coming-of-age story about a father and a son. The young man comes of age. The father is a craftsman who makes these retablos, which are these little wooden cabinets that are painted beautiful colors, and you open them up, and inside are these little kind of clay figurines representing a family vignette. The father has brought his teenage son up to learn the trade with him. They live up in the mountains of Peru, and they go down into the village to sell these retablos every so often. But the father conceals a painful secret, and the son learns about this secret, and that comes out through the process, through the story, and he has to grapple with the fact that his father is not who he thinks he is. It's beautifully made. It's a debut film from this really talented upcoming filmmaker, and I thought it was excellent. It's really worth seeing.
The film is Retablo. Again, it's Peru's entry for Best International Feature Film, what used to be called Best Foreign Language category at the Oscars. And that director and co-screenwriter is Alvaro Delgado Aparicio. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. Coming up, we're going to hear what Wade thinks about a documentary, which is just getting a single-day screening in Los Angeles and across the country, Never Surrender, a Galaxy Quest documentary. And we're going to use that as a springboard to talk about our critics' favorite spoofs, as of course Galaxy Quest, a wonderful spoof of Star Trek. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes. That's the theme from Galaxy Quest, wonderful satire, lovingly presented of Star Trek. Galaxy Quest is going to be screened this coming Tuesday in select theaters across the country. We have a link on our Film Week page to the theaters that will be showing the film. And they'll be showing this documentary, Never Surrender, a Galaxy Quest documentary. So you can watch Galaxy Quest on your favorite streaming service, then go see the documentary on Tuesday. Wade, what'd you think of the doc?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, Galaxy Quest kind of came out of the blue for a lot of people. Nobody really expected it to walk that great line between being a tribute and a spoof. It loves the subject that it is spoofing, and it winds up now having a fan following based on par with the fan following that it was spoofing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's covered here. They talk to some super fans and they go back and they revisit all the surviving cast members, all of whom obviously love Alan Rickman and pay him great tribute as well. And looking back
as the Spock-like character.
As the Spock character. And it is really very loving. It is very insightful. My only slight grievance with it is that one of the executive producers sort of gives short shrift to the original screenwriter, David Howard, whose original spec script, Captain Starshine, was the source of this. David Howard is a good friend of mine, and his contribution was arbitrated by the Writers Guild. He was given story credit and co-screenplay credit, and very deservedly so. So without his original script, the movie wouldn't exist. So despite that, everybody in here really, really does just sort of, it's charming how astonished they are at how the longevity of the film and its fan passion has prevailed.
Well, let's hear from the film. 1999's Galaxy Quest, great cast of Alan Rickman, Sigourney Weaver, Tony Shalhoub, and Tim Allen.
How did I come to this?
Not again.
I played Richard III.
Five curtain calls.
There were five curtain calls. I was an actor once. Damn it, now look at me. Look at me! I can't go out there and I won't say that stupid line one more time. I can't. I won't.
Well, Alex, at least you had a part. Okay? You had a character people loved. I mean, my TV Guide interview was six paragraphs about my boobs and how they fit into my suit. No one even bothered to ask me what I do on the show.
You had the... Wait, I'll think of it.
I repeated the computer, Fred.
Whew! Your commander is on deck. Ha ha! Wow, that smog is thick today, huh? Am I too late for Alexander's panic attack? Apparently not.
Tim Allen as the Kirk-like star of the series, William Shatner-like. Dean Parisot, is that how you say his name?
Yeah,
Parisot, the director of Galaxy Quest. So there are a lot of great parody films that are out there, and I want to ask each of you about your favorite. Charles, let me start with you. Animation, is there a...
There are lots of them, and one that I think we have a clip of is the Scarlet Pumpernickel of Daffy trying to land the role of a swashbuckling hero at Warner Brothers.
I'm telling you, J.O., you're typecasting me to death. Comedy. All this comedy. Ha ha. Yes, yak. Honest, J.L., you just gotta give me a dramatic part.
Well,
I knew you'd see it my way, J.L., and it just so happens that I have with me the very script that we've been looking for.
Yes, but I...
Let's see now, where to begin? Oh, yes, page one. The Scarlet Pumpernickel by Daffy Dumas Duck.
Well, Warner Brothers cartoons were constantly sending up things.
Oh, yeah. Everything was spoofed in it, from popular songs to movies to actors. That was their stock in trade, as was Rocky and Bullwinkle. But in live action, I'd have to pick Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, I really wish God had let us keep Madeline Kahn longer.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frederick?
No, Frederick.
Well, why isn't it Frederick Frankenstein?
It isn't. It's Frederick Frankenstein.
I see.
You must be Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
But they told me it was Igor.
Well, they were wrong then, weren't they?
The late Marty Feldman, another one we lost to young. Charles, it's that film, arguably the best of Mel Brooks's parodies.
Yeah, and just flawlessly cast, and everyone is clearly both being their character and having so much fun. I don't see it could not reduce you to hysterics.
I'd also throw in High Anxiety,
yes,
by Mel Brooks, another
spoof
of Hitchcock, yeah. And he nailed that. Lael, your favorites?
Oh gosh, well, I have to agree about Young Frankenstein. That was absolutely one of my favorites. Blazing Saddles, of course, would be a pretty good spoof of the westerns, also from Mel Brooks. I loved This Is Spinal Tap, which, you know, as a mockumentary, it certainly stands alone.
Most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Rob Reiner is such a great straight man as the documentarian. Christopher Guest, of course, as Nigel Tufnell in This Is Spinal Tap.
Oh, God.
So funny.
Yeah, it is the perfect mockumentary. And I think really kind of might have been one of the first of the mockumentaries in and of itself, right?
It was the one. It was not the first, but it was the one that popularized the form, that sort of showed everyone how far you could go and how much fun you could have.
Wasn't
with
there
it.
That? What, Here Come the Ruttles or something? Wasn't that one of them?
Was
like a Beatles.
Yeah.
So Wade, your favorites?
Boy, everything that has been said already. I mean, Young Frankenstein, Spinal Tap, High Anxiety. I love them all dearly. I'm gonna cite a few. More so than the Naked Gun movies, Police Squad, the TV series.
Oh, the TV series.
The TV series, Police Squad,
which can't find anywhere.
It's on DVD.
Okay, I've tried the streaming services, can't find it anywhere.
If you're a fan of procedurals, especially from the 50s and 60s, the original procedurals, Police Squad just nails them.
The shoeshine scenes.
Yes.
With, you know, he's the tipster, and they keep throwing like Tommy Lasorda and
brilliant.
All these.
It's just brilliant.
His, yeah.
And obviously, you know, the Airplane movies, including Airplane 2, which the Zazz team did not do, but it still has its moments. The OSS 117 films, the French films by Michel Hazanavicius with Jean Dujardin, I think are the best James Bond spoofs there are. And they spoof also the original OSS 117 serious movies in France. So I think those are incomparable. They're doing a third one now. Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Monty Python's Life of Brian, Tropic Thunder, Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby.
You got a lot of it. Well, let's listen to another one. You mentioned Airplane, one of my very favorites, 1980, and this is a satire of aircraft disaster films. Robert Hayes, Leslie Nielsen, and Julie Haggerty.
The stewardess said both pilots.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying, altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Altogether, indeed.
Ethel, I think we have to give kudos to Ethel Merman for that movie.
Oh, that's right. Yes, she was. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They think she's Ethel Merman, and there's Ethel Merman in the cast. That airplane from 1980, we have many more satirical films to come. What's your favorite parody? You can call in if you're listening to our live Friday show. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Your favorite film parody, this in light of the documentary on Galaxy Quest that screens one day only in select theaters next Tuesday. You can also post on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. As we listen to Robin Hood, Men in Tights, that was another one of those Mel Brooks parodies, his whole career devoted, of course, to parodies after The Producers, which launched its own musical follow-up. So we'll be continuing with Film Week and your calls, your suggestions, right here on 89.3 KPCC.
We're men in tights, always on guard, defending the
terrific music from Quincy Jones that was prominent in the Austin Powers series. Yet another spoof series, and that's what we're devoted to on Film Week. We welcome your input on the Film Week page at kpecc.org, where Rob Quint fondly remembers June Cleaver speaking jive in Airplane. That was I speak jive and translating it. 866-893-KPCC. If you're listening live on Friday, we welcome your favorites. But let's play another selection. Wade mentioned this, one of my favorites, Monty Python, The Holy Grail from 1975.
We have found the witch. May we burn her?
Burn her!
She is a witch.
She looks like one.
Yeah, she looks like one.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Ghost Waltz by Oliver Mayer, a bold original recovery of Juventino Rosas, one of Mexico's most significant composers. Follow Rosas from his father's early death to his friendship with ragtime genius Scott Joplin, now on stage through June 2nd. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Forward.
I'm not a witch. I'm not a witch.
But you are dressed as one.
They dressed me up like this.
And
this isn't my nose. It's a false one.
Well?
Well, we did do the nose.
The nose?
And the hat. But she's a witch.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Let's talk with Jeffrey in Beverly Hills. Your favorite spoof?
Yes, Danny Kaye's The Court Jester, 1954, is a loving comic version of The Adventures of Robin Hood, 1938, and countless swashbuckling films. Both the humor and affection toward the source are evident from the opening credits, where the animated letters of villainous Basil Rathbone's name chase Danny's name across the screen. And, of course, it showcases his particular talents for tongue-twisting patter, the pellet with the poisons and the vessel with the pestle, and his broad physical antics, marching at high speed with his coat of mail breeches sagging like droopy drawers.
Probably the best known of Danny Kaye's films. Jeffrey, thank you for The Court Jester. 866-893-KPECC for Friday listeners listening live. Saturday listeners, you can post your favorite parody on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. David, in West Los Angeles, your favorite parody?
Fear of a Black Hat. It spoofed the rise and story of NWA as they emerged out of Compton.
I remember that was not a hugely seen film, but any of the three of you remember Fear of a Black Hat?
Absolutely. Rusty Cundiff. Yeah, that's a terrifically funny movie. And that's basically a mockumentary as well.
All right. We have, let's see, Susan in Hollywood, your favorite satirical film.
Well, I had a couple, but Best in Show I thought was hysterical. And, you know,
spoofs the whole culture of dog shows, yes.
Absolutely. And the other thing I wanted to say is, why the heck didn't they do another Galaxy Quest? They set it up for a second one, and I kept waiting for it to happen. It's a hysterical show.
I think it'd be tough, though, to do a sequel. That is such, to me, a beautifully paced film and put together. That would be a tough one to do a sequel. My guess is it just wasn't a big enough box office film.
And in Never Surrender, they talk about the attempt to do a TV series, which was derailed when Alan Rickman died.
All right. Susan, appreciate it very much. Jameen, calling. Where are you calling from, Jameen?
It's Jamin. I'm calling from Orange County.
Oh, okay. Where in Orange County?
Right now I'm in Garden Grove.
Great. Okay. Go right ahead.
One of my favorite films of all time is Murder by Death.
Murder by Death.
Yes.
Spoof of Agatha Christie.
Mm-hmm. And it features a bunch of detectives from Agatha Christie and other series in there trying to solve a mystery.
Yeah, and Truman Capote and Maggie Smith.
Okay. All right, 866-893-KPCC. Let's see, we have David loves Top Secret with Val Kilmer. Mm-hmm. Says truly a forgotten classic, Top Secret. Christopher says Girls Will Be Girls. It's a 2003 comedy film from Richard Day. It's in drag. Everything is spoofed in that film. Bill wonders, would Get Smart count? Yes, Buck Henry's.
For sure. Definitely.
And Mel Brooks' collaboration on that. And he also wonders, does anyone remember the TV show When Things Were Rotten?
Yeah, Dick Gautier. That was another Mel Brooks and spoof of Robin Hood.
All right. Norma in Lakewood, Hot Fuzz, she is a fan of. 866-893-KPECC or our Film Week page, kpecc.org. Keaton in Larchmont Village says 200 Cigarettes, a spoof on New Year's movies and one of Keaton's favorites. It was a 1999 film. Let's see. Sean and Sherman Oaks, also a big fan of the Christopher Guest spoofs. In addition to Best in Show, the one which parodied the folk singer genre, A Mighty Wind, which was also. And Matthew says, how can you not mention Dr. Strangelove? I don't think of that as a parody of film, though, so much. That's more a parody of government, right?
Yeah, and politics.
Yeah.
It's Strangelove is really its own. Yeah. Its own creature. It's a species unto itself.
Vicky in Monrovia, your favorite parody?
It would be the Pink Panthers. Mm. Mm.
Oh, yes. With Richard Williams' amazing title sequences and, of course, Peter Sellers mangling the English language.
Henry Mancini's great music to that. In fact, we used it as our Film Week theme just last week from the Pink Panthers. We're doing our starts of Film Week with a different movie music example each week. Vicky, thanks very much. 866-893-5722. Cleona in Atwater Village, your favorite parody.
Hey, Larry, it is What We Do in the Shadows, the Taika Waititi spoof of the mockumentary where they are vampires living in the outskirts of a city in New Zealand. And really, all they want is to be friends with the locals and to integrate themselves, but also how they deal with their arch enemies, the werewolves. And then, of course, the subsequent TV series. It was extraordinary and very, very ridiculously funny.
I've caught just snippets of it, and it was hilarious what I saw, What We Do in the Shadows.
I know there was one anime vampire spoof where the heroine gave people blood because she had too much and the problems that caused. I don't remember the title, but it was a hoot.
Yeah, so much of what we review, you know, is Japanese animation, Charles, because so much terrific stuff is being done in Japan. Is this part of Japanese culture to do parodies?
They'll be very silly. I love Martian successor Nadesico, which is a spoof of not only sci-fi giant robot movies, but a fandom, because everybody worships a fake 70s giant robot that's Geki Gangar 3, and they even have a Geki Gangar Fest that's a spoof of anime conventions, on the spaceship.
All right. Helene in Los Alamitos, High Anxiety. I mentioned that's such a great Hitchcock spoof. I agree with you on that, right down to the music, which is just terrific in that film. Well, for our Film Week critics, Lowenstein, Wade Major, Charles Solomon, I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, on our Film Week page, kpecc.org, you can add your favorite film parodies throughout the course of the weekend. Your fellow Film Week listeners can be picking up tips from there. Hey, I also want to let you know tickets are now on sale for our Film Week Academy Awards preview. It's the 18th annual edition on Sunday, February 2nd, 11 in the morning at the Theater at Ace Hotel. I certainly hope that you have a chance to join us for that. Get your tickets now. We close out with music from Spinal Tap, the 1984 mockumentary, Tonight I'm Gonna Rock You Tonight. Have a great weekend from all of us at Film Week.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.